meeting of House Judiciary to order. Present with us right now are Representative Klayman, Representative Lynn, Vice Chair Keller, and Representative Foster, and I'm Representative Ledoux, Chair of the Committee. I'll remind everybody to begin with to please silence their cell phones. We have two bills before us today. House Bill 75, Municipal Regulation of Marijuana. That's a bill that has been previously heard. And HB 106, Uniform International Child Support Parentage. I am hopeful that we can move HB 75 out of committee today, but do not anticipate HB 106 having that good fortune. First, HB 75.
Can you wait 1 minute before you get HB 75?
She's smiling anyway.
Eddings. Record and let the record reflect that Representative Millett has joined us. To begin with, House Bill 75 presenting is Representative Tilton and her staff, Heath Hilliard, a committee aide to House Community and Regional Affairs. I believe that we have a new CS for this bill. Could I have a motion to bring the new version V before the committee?
Madam Chair, I move version B of House Bill 75 before the committee as a working document.
Thank you. Hearing no objections, yes, for House Bill 75, version V is before the committee. Representative Tilton, please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kathy Tilton, representing House District 12 and Chair of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. I just wanted to thank the Chair for working with us over the past few weeks to work on the CS, and I appreciate all the work that's being done on this. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my aide, Heath Hilliard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, staff representative Tilton, and committee aide of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Today I bring before you CS for HB 75 /V, which you have adopted. I'm going to go through primarily the explanation of changes because the sectional hasn't changed dramatically, and I just want to highlight the amendments from the S version to the V version. So with that, I'll walk through the explanation of changes and answer any questions the committee may have about those changes. First and foremost, one of the things that we did was we significantly tightened the title that can be found on page 1, lines 1 through 6. Section 2, there was some discussion previously in the previous committee hearing, municipalities expressing their preference for the term dwelling versus residence. We ran that through legal services, and they said functionally for the purposes of Alaska statute that they were functionally interchangeable and it was more preferable for ordinance language, so residence has been changed to dwelling. In addition, we also increased the household plant limit from 12 plants to 24. I previously explained the rationale that the Community and Regional Affairs Committee had come to with 12, but Madam Chair, as you brought up in discussion from the last committee hearing, there was some confusion about was there an existing limit on the books, and that prompted Mr. Wheeler from the Municipality of Anchorage to send me the Hochram case, which dealt with that issue, but in reading through that case law, we identified that there is existing statute that makes reference to 24, essentially the statute, and I believe it's in your packets, it's in Title 11, it's 1171-040-3G. Anything in excess of 25 plants under current criminal law is presumed possession with intent to distribute. Anything under 25 is assumed to be for personal use, consistent with the Raven and Noy decisions. So we increase that to 24 plants. Section 11, page 6, line 22, there is an addition of the phrase consistent with the, and this has to do with the Administrative Procedures Act. It was noted that a number of the larger municipalities have their own functional ordinances that act as an Administrative Procedures Act, and so that phrase allows them to use their own ordinances and prevent any potential confusion between what they have on their books and what the State Administrative Procedures Act provides for.
Excuse me, yes. Mr. Hilliard, where is that that you're talking about?
It should be on page 6, line 22. Yes, These procedures shall be consistent with requirements of AS 4462.
All right. Was there any change on page 2 and 3, section 5 through page 3, line 5? Is that in the previous version?
That was in the previous CS. Correct, ma'am. That was that language, again, and I will give you the history, brief history from the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. The municipal attorneys that have been advising us on continuing to craft this legislation had asked for additional sideboards on defining what assisting properly means. We were given draft language by one of the municipal attorneys who, again, has been assisting us, Ms. Doxy from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I provided that sample language, and the language you see before you is what legal services returned back to us. It is not exactly similar to what we were provided, but that was what legal services provided back to us. And so there has not been a change since the S version.
Thank you.
Continuing on.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question.
And by the way, Representative Greenberg has joined us.
I have a question on Section 5. Do you want me to wait, or we'll bring it up?
Probably let Mr. Hellyard go through his presentation, and then we can pepper him with questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keller. I wanted to point out Section 14, page 7, lines 9 through 14. This was an amendment that was identified by Representative Keller and his staff. This provision was included, the language, essentially we identified a gap with enforcement. For instance, second-class boroughs don't have general police powers or health powers, and so the way that original language was included in the initiative, there would be a situation where, for instance, if the municipality issued the registration and the registrant was acting improperly, that the municipality itself would not have the ability to enforce, but would have to depend entirely on the state. And so there was essentially a gap, and so what we did is we closed that loophole to say that essentially at any time the state also has the enforcement authority for activities on commercial marijuana establishments. So that I believe that corrected the language there, section 14, page 7, line 9 through 14, corrected the situation that was identified by Representative Keller and his staff. Section 16, page 7, lines 23, again, similar to the change that we made to the Administrative Procedures Act provision in Section 11. This says, again, similar to change in Section 11, municipalities use local ordinances that are substantially similar or consistent with AS 4462, the Administrative Procedures Act. Again, it was simply a sort of a cleanup that we wanted to make sure that municipalities were not unnecessarily bound to particular language that might conflict with their own ordinances. And then lastly, several of the sections throughout the remainder of the bill have been renumbered accordingly as a result of drafting changes.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Representative, for Mr. Hellyard? Representative Keller.
Yeah, go back, if you would, to page 3, section 5.
Page 3, 1, second.
Page 3, section 5. And line 18, I just want to know, what was the rationale on the half of the registration? Was it looked at in the context of responsibilities that are going to be shared for the enforcement, for the regulation, for the cost of application? Is that, why is that 50-50?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I actually can't answer that question because that was not our language. That was language that came directly from the initiative.
I see. Okay.
So if you section 5, I considered essentially non-substantive because the only real substantive change, well, the only real change in Section 5 pertaining to HB 75 was primarily the reference to from local government to municipality. So the language you're looking at, we had no rationale because it wasn't our language.
Okay. No, thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Hellyard? Representative Lynn.
On Section 17, Frame 2, would you explain again why we went from 12 plants to 24 plants per drum?
Through the chair, Lynn, I think you're talking about Section 2.
Yes, Section 2.
Section 2, line 21 through 20.
Yes.
Yeah, line 21.
Yeah.
Through Chair Representative Lynn, as I indicated, there had been a discussion in the previous committee hearing in which the Chair had opined or discussed that she believed there was something in statute or there was some previous case law that directed toward 24 as an existing limit. And as I indicated when I was walking through that, Dennis Wheeler, the municipal attorney from Anchorage, provided us the Hotrun case in which there was a situation the defendant tried to argue in terms of how much he possessed, consistent with Noy and Raven, so on and so forth. In short, there is existing statute in Title 11 that stipulates that anything over 25 plants is a criminal charge. It's possession with the intent to distribute, or I believe that, or it's a criminal misconduct involving controlled substance. The presumption is that 24 or less is presumed for personal use under the provisions of Raven and Noy.
I see. Thank you very much. At the appropriate time, I may offer an amendment.
Thank you.
And tell me when.
Representative Greenberg.
Through the Chair, Mr. Hillier, could you give me a cite on that statute?
Through the Chair, Representative Greenberg, and I think it should be in your packet, it's 1171-0403-G.
Any other questions for Ms. Representative Keller?
Page 6, line 4. The question I have there is that it's my understanding that criminal penalties can only be set by a first-class bill or a home rule bill, not a broader, this just uses the term municipality, which would include both those, but it also includes others, and so it seems like maybe that would be tightened up a little bit.
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, and I know that that has been brought to our attention before. Certainly the CNRA committee's intention was not to provide municipalities with powers they don't currently have. I believe there is a legal memo that was dated earlier this month from Ms. Martin, and we were addressing that exact question. Currently, AS 2925070 does provide certain municipalities with a limited amount of penalty authority, and if I, with the Chair's indulgence, just read briefly. For the violation of an ordinance, a municipality may by ordinance prescribe a penalty not to exceed a fine of $1,000 and imprisonment for 90 days. And I can say that on behalf of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee, it was not the intention of the committee to provide municipalities with authorities they don't currently possess. And we didn't believe that that does that, but I can't say with 100% certainty. I would have to refer to Ms. Martin or one of the municipal attorneys I think we have online.
If we have them online, I would, Madam Chair, I would really like to hear the answer to that, because maybe it's sufficient that it's on the record, but it may not be hard.
We have two municipal attorneys online. We have Amy Mead from Juneau, and we have Dennis Wheeler. Would either of those two care to answer that question? All right, hearing no volunteers, Ms. Mead, would you like to answer the question?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, this is Dennis Wheeler.
Thank you.
Could you repeat that question again so I'll make sure I answer it correctly?
Well, yeah, I'll repeat it, but I'm really kind of wondering if this isn't more appropriately for the drafter of the legislation. We're talking legislative language, but if you go to page 6, up on line 4, where it talks about the municipality may establish civil and criminal penalties. And I know there's some things in a way that only the first class bill and the home rule bill can do, and I don't think criminal penalties is one of them. And I think this may be creating a power for other municipality types that wasn't intended, according to the sponsor.
Through the Chair, Dennis Wheeler, municipal attorney for Moose Island and Anchorage. Because I represent a home rule, I don't know all the ins and outs for those jurisdictions that are not home rule, but for us, you know, we have a significant number of laws that are local misdemeanor offense laws that we enforce every day through our police department. So for us, this language clarifies that to the extent that we can, that we already have the ability to create misdemeanor offenses, that we could continue to do so in this particular arena. Your question, as you note, may be better for somebody in the state to answer with respect to whether or not this opens the door to second-class bills and so forth. But from our perspective for home rule, this just clarifies that we could continue to enact misdemeanor offense ordinances. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. I note for the record we have Casey Schroeder here from the Department of Law, and we also have Nancy Mead here from the court system. I'm wondering whether either of those two, seeing heads being shaken, would...
Is Hillary out? Could we call her?
Yeah, at ease. We consider the bill, we can consider a conceptual amendment to take care of that if it is in fact needed. Representative Keller?
Yeah, now I have another question, it's okay. Yeah, you really, is it, I would just would like to suggest a conceptual amendment if anybody else besides me is a little bit confused, but when you read and try to sort out if it's the board we're talking about, the state, or if it's a local, something put together by the local. Yeah, for example, on page 8, line 22, is it clear that the board is always referring to the state control board? That is, in the conceptual amendment that I would propose on this is just that the drafters would review it and make sure it's clear so we don't unintended consequences. So.
Could you repeat that again?
Okay. I just want to know whether the board in on page 8, line 22, is talking about the state, or whatever, the control board is still pending, or if it could apply to some municipal regulatory board, or, it just seemed like there's confusion there that goes back and forth.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, again, that is not community and regional affairs language, that is taken directly from the initiative. In reading this, the board here is presumed to be the Alcohol Beverage Control Board in the absence of a Marijuana Control Board. The initiative language provides that the legislature may enact or adopt a Marijuana Control Board, but the initiative language doesn't presume that they will do that. So the board in this circumstance is presumed to be the Alcohol Beverage Control Board unless a Marijuana Control Board is established.
Follow up.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, I think it's enough to just put it on the record that the drafter should please review the use of the word board and make sure that it's clear throughout the legislation. And I'm sure they would do that without me asking, but by putting it on the record, it puts a little bit more motivation to look. So.
And through the chair again, Representative Keller, the drafter took, obviously, the relevant portions of Title 1738, which was drafted by the initiative sponsors. So that was, this is not drafter language, this is the language she took directly from the initiative sponsors.
Follow up. What we pass here is going to be the product of the legislative language, because there are changes, there are tweaks as we go. So when we get done after the law passes, we can't go back and say, well, that confusion factor is in there, and it's not our fault. I mean, our drafter needs to look at that and make sure that there isn't a, in this case, it's almost a in the category of a typo, just making sure that it's clear, you know, that, yeah, that it's there. So we have that responsibility. So.
You can proceed.
Actually, I have a follow-up question.
Go ahead.
This is a follow-up question to some questions that Representative Keller was asking on page 6, line 4. Just for purposes of clarification, Section 9, the language, all in Section 9, is all the initiative language, except where you're changing local government to municipality, and then the language in criminal is something that was not in the initiative, and that's being added. But everything else in Section 9 is essentially initiative language with some technical changes to change the verb tense and whatnot.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have nothing further. That concludes my explanation of changes, but I am certainly happy to answer any additional questions that any of the committee members might have.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have any further questions from the committee? All right. We don't have public testimony, but we do have invited testimony today. And it looks like we've got one person, Dennis Wheeler from the municipality of Anchorage, who would like to testify. So I will open it up for Mr. Wheeler's testimony. Mr. Wheeler, are you still on the line?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Want to say that...
And can you again identify yourself for the record just to make things clear?
Yes, Dennis Wheeler, municipal attorney, municipality of Anchorage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sometimes we say nice things because we really want the bill to move forward, and sometimes we say nice things because we appreciate the work that folks have done. And I'd like to say that's true in both cases here. We definitely appreciate the way that the sponsor, Representative Tilton, and her staff, particularly Mr. Hilliard, reached out to local jurisdictions and worked with all of us to allow us to have input on the bill. I think this bill is a very good product, and I know that my office supports this particular version of the bill, even though there may be some minor tweaks here and there that could still be done. I think all in all it's a good product that should move so that when the state develops whatever it's going to do on the commercial side in terms of regulations and statutes and whether or not there's going to be a marijuana control board, at least the local governments have set out and have available to them some basic parameters within which to work so that we can do what we need to do to regulate it at the local level. So I wanted to express my thanks to the sponsor and her staff for how this was managed so that we had a good opportunity to provide our input, and I am more than willing to answer any questions the committee members may have on the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wheeler. Do we have any questions for Mr. Wheeler? Well, again, thank you very much, and thank you for being here and for helping out both CRA and Judiciary in crafting this bill. And we also have Amy Mead on the line. Ms. Mead?
Yes, my name is Amy Mead. I'm the municipal attorney for the City and Borough of Juneau. I echo Mr. Wheeler's sentiment with respect to the efforts made by Representative Tilton's office to include the municipalities in this process. Myself, along with Deputy Municipal Attorney Jane Stevens, were part of the group of municipal attorneys who worked with the representative's office on this bill. I'd like to voice my support and appreciation. The bill contains a lot of important provisions that were left unanswered by the initiative, provisions that will assist us in drafting the local legislation necessary to allow us to responsibly regulate the new business that is coming as part of this process. In particular, we very much appreciate that the bill includes a definition of assisting, that it provides a protest process, that it recognizes marijuana clubs as a type of marijuana establishment, fixes the Administrative Procedure Act issue, and that it allows us to impose criminal sanctions for time, place, and manner violations, which is consistent with our other land use regulation and consistent with the powers provided to municipalities under Alaska Statute 2935010 and 2925070. So I'm very hopeful that the committee will allow this bill to move forward, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Ms. Mead? Representative Kleinman.
I have no questions, but I just asked Ms. Mead and Mr. Wheeler to remain online because we've got some amendments that I may have some questions for them during the course of the amendments.
Thank you. Ms. Mead and Mr. Wheeler, can you remain online?
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, we will now close invited public testimony. And is there any questions or discussion about this bill? Are there any amendments with respect to this bill?
Madam Chair?
Representative Lynn.
Yes, I have an amendment. May we call it Amendment 1?
Yes, we can call it Amendment 1.
And very simple amendment, page 2, line 21, and it changes the number of plants it passed from 24 down to 12, and that's kind of a happy medium between 0 and 24, cut right in the middle. I don't think we need a forest of plants and anybody's dwelling, and I think 12 should be a reasonable compromise.
I object. And Representative Klayman.
I don't want to...
I don't need to speak to the objection. I think 24 is too many for a dwelling. I think 12 is a reasonable compromise for that, and everybody should be happy with the 12, and that's my answer to the objection, and I still maintain the amendment.
And it is my feeling, actually, that the 24 is a compromise. I view the terms of the initiative as allowing 6 plants per person, regardless of how many people there are in a household. And I've heard from many constituents on this, wanting to honor the will of the people. Nevertheless, in order to make matters easier for the municipalities in establishing a bright line, it seems appropriate to use the same bright line that the municipalities have been using and the police have been using for years to determine what is intent to sell. So I will be maintaining my objection. Representative Mellett.
I believe Representative Lynn, I understand your position, but I agree with Madam Chair that I think the closest we can say to the initiative, the better case the state's going to be in, especially if it comes down to some type of lawsuit that puts us in error with the what the people voted for and what the intent of the initiative was. So I'm not going to be voting for this amendment, but I understand your concerns greatly.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I will be supporting the amendment, and I want to make it clear that the number is 6, and that anything we pick above 6 is an arbitrary number to match whatever a household means, and we're setting a bright line. And we have testimony that has told us that they don't care really what it is as long as there's a line set, and I don't see any justification to go right up to the maximum allowed by law 24. So I will be supporting the amendment.
For any further discussion, Representative Klayman.
I just want to briefly note that I, too, will be supporting the chair and not voting for this amendment. I view the 24 as a compromise. I think, given the language of the amendment about 6 plants, there may well be a successful constitutional argument that if you had 6 adults in a house, that the limit would be 36 plants. And while my own sense was that it would be a... One way to approach it would be that you could have 6 times the number of adults over 21 living in the household. That seems sort of ambiguous, or not ambiguous, but more complicated to apply. And so I saw the 24 plants as a bright line and a compromise, and the best way to proceed, both in light of the Hotram case, which has been provided by Mr. Wheeler and is a published Alaska Court of Appeals case, and as well as the other reasons have been articulated. So I will not be supporting the amendment.
Any other discussion, Representative?
Thank you. Just for the record, I'll associate myself with Representative Klayman's comments.
Anybody else? All right. Do you still maintain your...
Yes.
All right.
Pardon me?
Oh, you're right.
What do you think?
I continue to maintain my objection. Madam Clerk, could you please call the roll?
Yes. Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Keller?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Millett?
No.
Representative Klayman?
No.
Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Representative Leduc?
No.
There are 2 in favor.
All right, so the amendment fails, but I also understand your concerns, Representative Lynn.
Thank you for considering the amendment.
Madam Chair, I would offer, I have an amendment.
Go ahead, Representative Klein.
This is, if we could call this amendment number two, it's on page 6, line 4. And that should have been distributed earlier. As to page 6, line 4, the amendment would delete the words "and criminal." The primary reason that I'm moving for this amendment is that I am very committed to supporting the language of the ballot initiative. I was publicly a no vote on the ballot initiative, but I recognize that the majority of the public has voted in favor of this ballot initiative, and the language of the ballot initiative only references civil penalties, not criminal penalties. I believe it's a matter of standard statutory construction that the Supreme Court have asked to analyze the initiative would presume that every word that was included has meaning, and words that were not included in the mind of the voters that approved the initiative would have intention that they intended not to include those words, and so to add the word "and criminal" is actually changing the jurisdiction and taking language that's different from the what I believe to be the intent of the voters as expressed in the plain language of the amendment. So for those reasons, I would move to remove "and criminal" from page 6, line 4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Is there any Representative Keller?
Yeah, your logic that because the word "criminal" is not in the initiative means that their intent was to not allow for a criminal penalty is a leap, I think. I mean, in other words, it's when the initiative was made, it did not, if they wanted to make the statement that you were proposing with this amendment, they would have said that there would be no civil or no criminal penalties allowable. So.
If I could respond, there's two features. The first thing to remember is that this particular bill actually relates to the regulation of marijuana, not to the question of civil penalties, which is a completely different bill. And in the memo that came from Legislative Legal that's dated March 2nd, that is part of the information that's been distributed from Hillary Martin, and on the second page of that, in the second paragraph, the Legislative Affairs Attorney specifically notes in the middle saying it is possible that the intent of this language is to prevent a municipality from imposing criminal penalties on violations of the ordinance, as only civil penalties are mentioned. So the reason that I don't think it's a leap of faith is because, first of all, we're really not dealing with the broad scheme of criminal penalties, but we're actually focused only on the question of regulations affecting those that get permits to be in the marijuana sales and growing business, and in that context where they, certainly under long Supreme Court doctrine, under the Alaska Supreme Court, they would read the fact that there is no language in there about criminal penalties as noted in this Legislative Affairs memo. They would look at that as a reason to limit the powers just to civil penalties.
Quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
And that is exactly my point. The fact that it is a possible interpretation, and it did not say that is the language. But I would, the reason really is that I would like to, if it's okay with the chair, to ask the sponsor to give us a little bit more of why that was put in there again, or maybe a repetition for the record, just for the sake of context.
Yes, and I would actually like to ask a couple of the municipal attorneys how they regulate and enforce, or whether they do enforce or have criminal ordinances with respect to alcohol sales. So could the bill sponsor...
Yes, I apologize, Madam Chair.
Would you like to ask your question?
Oh, I just was hoping that you could give us just a little bit of historical background on the discussion around inserting this language in the other committee.
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, thank you for that question. Yes, this was one of the points that was discussed early in the portion of developing HB 75 in its current iteration. The question arose in discussion with municipal attorneys. Again, I cited the Title 29 statute that provides certain municipalities with limited criminal penalty authority. And the rationale in discussing, and I believe that Mr. Wheeler alluded to that also today, was that it wasn't abundantly clear how the Title 29 statute would apply. And so the municipalities that do have general police authority, they wanted to make it clear that they still maintain the ability to adopt criminal penalties specifically for time, place, manner violations of commercial establishments. In further discussion with municipal attorneys, it had been suggested that it would perhaps be unlikely that local assemblies or city councils may adopt those. They simply wanted to have that ability in case it was necessitated.
Thank you. We still have Mr. Wheeler and Ms. Mead on the line?
Yes.
So my question is, are municipalities allowed to have criminal penalties for violation of ordinances or regulations with respect to time, place, manner, et cetera, with respect to alcohol establishments?
Well, this is Amy Mead, and the City and Borough of Juneau does.
Thank you.
Mayor Dennis Wheeler, Municipality of Anchorage. We do, too, under our municipal code, Title 8, Chapter 35. We have a number of ordinances that make it misdemeanor offenses to violate the rules there, including hours of service, serving underage persons, allowing persons who are intoxicated on premise, and so on and so forth. So they're readily available to anybody who wants to look at those in our Title 8, Chapter 35. Thank you.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. the language of the bill says a municipality may establish civil and criminal penalties. First of all, and I'm supportive of the amendment, but I'm giving the reasons here. First of all, it does not limit it to municipalities that already have the power. Read directly and literally, it's not so limited. And it could be read as giving municipalities that don't have that power already and haven't gone through the process additional power to do that. Now, I don't know if that argument would fly in view of the fact that there's no amendment to the governing statutes in Title 29 on municipal powers, but it could create litigation. That's number one. Number two, in answer to what Representative Keller said a few minutes ago, whether it should not violate the initiative because that language on line four doesn't say may establish only civil or may establish civil but not criminal. I believe a court would apply the rule that because the initiative does not just say penalties, but says civil penalties, that would be read as excluding criminal. Normally, the rules of statutory construction only require that things that are included be put into the statute. For example, if there's an ordinance that says you can keep horses and cows in your yard, that would be read as excluding rhinoceroses. They don't have to put rhinoceroses, pythons, mice, etc. All you have to put is what is included. And if there'd been nothing there, then conceivably it could be read the other way, but because they only said civil, I think a court would read that excludes criminal.
Thank you. Representative Keller.
Yeah, we're not a court. We're dealing with language that we're going to decide whether or not to put in Alaska statute formally, you know, with tweaks and whatever. But if we wanted to clarify, according to your argument, to make sure this was crystal clear, that we would have to include language that says that the civil and not criminal. And I think that it's not our role to sit here and decide what the intent was. I think our role is to clarify what we want to go into statute. So I just think that it's great to leave it in there. And now, for the record, also, your argument that you used, I intend to propose a conceptual amendment that limits the this section to municipalities that already have the power to establish criminal statutes. So that would answer that.
With that conceptual amendment, I don't have any problem with this language. After hearing from the City and Borough of Juneau and the Municipality of Anchorage, that is how liquor is regulated, and so it doesn't seem to me to be violative of the spirit of the initiative that we allow municipalities to regulate marijuana establishments in the same manner. Does anybody else want to discuss this amendment? Well, I am going to maintain my objection. So, Madam Clerk, would you please call the roll? Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, on the amendment.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Keller?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Klayman?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Sorry. 3 in favor, 4 against.
Madam Chair?
Representative Keller.
Just to kind of continue on this topic, I would propose a conceptual amendment, because it fits in the same discussion, on page 6, line 3, after the word municipality, insert the words with power to establish civil and criminal penalties, and then continue on as it is written, may establish civil and criminal penalties. Because it's conceptual, it's clumsy, but I think it's clear. You attorneys that want to talk to the attorneys that may draft may be able to clean that up a little bit, but I think it's clear to everybody on the committee what we're trying to do is say that only the municipality that currently has the power to set criminal penalties should be allowed to set criminal penalties.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do support the amendment.
And I will object for purposes of discussion, Representative Gruenberg.
I do support the amendment number 3, and that helps with the problem.
Any further discussion on this? I'll remove my objection. So are there any further amendments?
I have one last amendment, Madam Chair. Relating to starting on page 2, line 29.
What line?
Starting on page 2, line 29. And we'll number it number 4. For purposes of discussion, you should have one on your desk.
Let me look.
Did I say 2? I apologize. It should be 4. It should be number 4.
I'm trying to.
Because 3 is the conceptual amendment from Representative Keller.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I may might have it in here somewhere, but I don't see it. Thank you. to read this.
I'd like to call the meeting back to order. Representative Klangman.
All right. So amendment number four addresses there's a kind of three different layers of the assisting language that is added into the CS that's now before us. And the reason I'm making the amendment is that because I find the language that is included in this trying to do something about assisting, I find it vague, ambiguous, and frankly, every time I try to read it, I don't really understand it. Because we're in this kind of interesting place when we look at section 2, which starts up above, what we're doing is it starts out that notwithstanding whatever else is the law, it will be lawful and not criminal under Alaska law to possess, use, display, purchase, transport marijuana accessories, subparagraph 2, grow marijuana, number 3, transfer 1 ounce or less of marijuana, number 4, consume marijuana, and then using the specific language of the amendment, or not of the initiative, paragraph 5 is that you can assist another person who's 21 years of age or older in doing all of 1 through 4, which was assist in possessing marijuana. And then, so what we have is we have previously marijuana is not allowed. Possession of marijuana is generally illegal, except as protected by Raven. And then what we're now saying is what was previously something you can't do, now it is no longer prohibited, now it's specifically lawful to do this, and now we're trying to create a negative on the negative by trying to say what assisting is. And when I specifically draw your attention to subparagraph C of the assisting language, growing marijuana plants from another person in a place other than that other person's dwelling, and this becomes good. I understand Mr. Wheeler, well, I'm not sure whether it was Mr. Wheeler or the attorney from Juneau, but I understand this was urged by the municipality, so I actually have questions for them. I'm a little bit, I don't really understand in paragraph C how a person, say, is asked to be a house sitter for their neighbor while their neighbor is gone to visit their family on a state or to another community in our state, and that neighbor is growing marijuana plants. How can the person go and water the plants as part of the house sitting, and how do you answer that, where on paragraph 5 it basically says you can assist in somebody to grow plants at their house, and in paragraph 5C you're trying to say you can't do it, and it seems to be that they're totally in contradiction. And I'm asking the attorneys, because they're the ones that I think have been in favor of this language, I'm trying to get them to explain how this works, because I don't really understand it, and I'm not sure whether it's Mr. Weaver that should answer, or, and I apologize, the other attorney's last name I've forgotten.
That's okay, it's Ms. Mead.
Ms. Mead, I apologize. Okay, so if one of you do want to offer up and explain to me how that works, it would be helpful, because I haven't been able to figure it out.
I wasn't the one who asked for it, and Mr. Wheeler might have more to add, but I think that this paragraph would allow someone to go to, let's say you left town and you asked me to house sit your plants for you. That would allow me to go do that. What it would prohibit would be me sending a note to 20 of my neighbors telling them that I will grow their plants for them in my house, and me ending up with 80 plants. I think that's what it was intended to prohibit, to allow a communal growing situation in one dwelling.
And so, to a follow-up question to the, so if the concern is that somebody's going to try to be a community grower, how does that get a person that's growing more than 24 plants, how does that get them around the 24 plant limit that we've just enacted, or that we haven't enacted, but that's part of subparagraph 2 that's specifically permitted? I mean, aren't the police basically going to be going and saying, how many plants do you have, and if you have more than 24 plants, then you kind of have a problem.
If there aren't enough adults living in the house. So it's still, the way that I read all of this together, the number of plants that are allowed in a particular dwelling are still tied to the number of persons over 21. The assisting language, what it does is prohibit someone doing a workaround, if you would, and growing plants for someone who is not residing in the home by claiming that I'm assisting my friend in growing his 6 plants, I'm just growing them here at my house. I live alone, I now have 12 plants.
But is there... I just don't... We already have a statute that deals with a legal accountability based on the conduct of another, which is 1116.110, the aiding and abetting statute that I'm sure you're familiar with. And how does somebody that's got 30 plants in their house, I just don't see how we specifically say you can assist somebody to grow marijuana. How do we get to basically try to negate what we've specifically told them they could do?
Well, and if I understand your question, one, I don't think the aiding and abetting statute applies. This isn't, it's not a criminal activity for every adult over the age of 21 to grow 6 plants in his or her home. Again, I think it's just trying to prohibit or prevent the situation where we have one person who's growing more than the number of plants that is otherwise authorized by claiming they're for someone else.
But follow up, but doesn't the current provisions only allow 24 plants in my own home? It doesn't allow me to have 24 plants in Representative Ledoux's home. I'm only allowed to have 24 plants in my own home, and if I have more than 24 plants in Representative Ledoux's involved, has given me 12 plants in addition to my 24, and I say, well, I'm assisting her, isn't she actually now in for aiding and abetting my having more than 24 plants? She doesn't live in my home. She has no right to have plants in my home.
Well, I think it would be you who would be in trouble, but you can't have 24 plants in your home unless you have 4 adults living there.
Well, I actually think under what we're proposing in this statute, 24 is the line, and a person could have 24 whether they have...
That certainly wasn't what anybody intended the line.
That's it. Well, okay. If there's one person, this is the reason why I think this whole amendment is so confusing, because it doesn't really address. It's trying to the initiative specifically says that you can assist another person in all these activities, and you're now trying to say, well, you can't assist those person in those very same activities, and I don't see how the person with 24 plants in their home, or who has 36 plants in their home, what is the basis for saying I'm assisting somebody that somehow creates a defense?
I don't understand what you're talking about at all right now.
Maybe I can say.
All right. Representative Grubag asked them.
Yeah, okay. One thing that I think we all try to do here, particularly in the area of criminal law, is to write things so clearly that the public, defenders, prosecutors, judges, and even legislators can understand what we're doing. And this provision of law is extremely confusingly written. It's a triple negative the way it is. and it is going to spawn litigation. I think with a little work, and I don't have language, but I think with a little work, it can be written more clearly. And that's why I think we ought to look at it not just the way you would look at it as prosecutors, but how it would be confusing to a reasonable person, even on a jury. You know, these things are going to go to juries. And everybody in this room can look at it like a juror. And they've got to be so clear that the jury will understand the judge's written instruction when they quote this.
You know, I understand what you're saying, Representative Grunberg, but I'm actually reading this language and I'm not having a problem with it. It looks to me like what it's saying is everybody gets their six plants. Mm-hmm. But if you're one person and you're caught with 12 plants, you can't say, well, these are my six and the other six are somebody else's and I'm just assisting them to grow their six plants. I mean, that's the way I'm reading it, at least.
May I respond?
Go ahead.
If that were the scenario, sure. But that's not the only scenario that this will arise in. Let's talk about the person who's watering somebody else's plants. They're assisting that person because they're making the plants survive. That could be read as a type of assistance. If we were to paraphrase the phrase in the movie 12 Angry Men, it would be people, this would be the kind of argument we'd be having in the jury room. Somebody would say, well, this person was assisting the person who had the plants because they were tilling the soil and feeding the plants plant food and watering them. And then somebody else would say, well, but they really should be in lieu because they were not involved in some of these other activities. And it would go back and forth, and I think it would engender confusion, not on you, or maybe me, but on maybe people who were not as familiar with the legal system. And what's the harm in trying to get it a little clearer? There's no harm done, and it may save the interpretation of the statute. There's nothing to lose, but given a day or so to see if this could be done any clearer. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you very much, Representative Grunberg. Is there any further discussion on this amendment?
No.
Does the sponsor of the bill have any clarification they'd like to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Heath Hilliard, staff for Representative Tilton. I think the linchpin with regard to lines, you know, essentially 29, page 2, line 29 through page 3, lines 5, is this. When you look at what is Section A, using this assisting under this paragraph does not include using, displaying, purchasing, or transporting marijuana in excess of the amount allowed in this section. Assisting does not include possessing, growing, processing, transporting marijuana in excess of the amount allowed in this section. Growing marijuana plants for another person in a place other than the other person's dwelling, to use the watering scenario, you can water your friend's plants all day long so long as those plants are in your friend's home.
So your friend can't say, I'm going away for a while. Can I bring my marijuana plants to your house?
Madam Chair, that would be my reading of that, but I can come over to your house and water them for you.
That would be my reading of it, too.
So you can babysit the plants at the person's house, you just can't babysit the plants at your own house.
If we didn't have attorneys, we wouldn't need them.
I have a follow-up question.
For Mr. Hilliard?
For Mr. Hilliard or for one of the attorneys on the line. You can the rock, scissors, paper, and choose the answers. What about if I don't have any plants in my house, why can't my neighbor bring the plants to my house that I can water while he's on vacation? He's moving over 24 because there are four adults in his house. Mr. Hill, you want to take that, or you want to get one of the attorneys on the line to take it?
Through the chair, as long as there's not more than six plants in your household at any given time, it really doesn't matter.
But my question is, why can't I assist my neighbor who has four adults that live in the house and they've all gone on vacation? Why can't I just say, bring the plants to my house and I'll water them while you're gone? Aren't I assisting them?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, no, because we're defining that that does not constitute assisting for the purposes of this paragraph. Unless one of the other attorneys would like, to take it, that's the way I'm reading it.
But just under this language, follow up through the chair, under this language, I specifically could not bring them to my house, whereas under, if you don't have these, except the language that's in the proposed, that I'm proposing to delete, if you didn't have that language, there would be a basis to say I could take them to my house.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, you can take six. If you have no other plants in your home.
That was the basis I had.
Representative Bloomberg.
I want to go back to my own potentially confusing interpretation of this. I think we would all agree that I'll have the mic closer, it's a good idea to try to make the law as clear as possible. There is nothing in a case of this type to be gained by having something confusingly written. I mean, there's no good reason not to clear it up. And the way this is written, on line 30, it says, assisting under this paragraph does not include. That phrase is confusing, because what you really want to say is even if you're helping somebody who's over 21, you're still criminally liable if you do the following things. That would be one way of very simply making it clearer. I don't want to just do something like this on the fly, though. And I think it could be just done with a few word change, and it would make it much clearer, because the way it is here now, I think this will lead to some confusion. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you. I appreciate your thoughts, Representative Greenberg. I don't have any problems with this language. I'm going to maintain my objection. Let's call the roll.
Representative Klayman.
Yes.
Representative Greenberg.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Keller.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Millett.
No.
Representative Ledoux.
No.
So two in favor, five against.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion on this bill? Could I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move CS for House Bill 75, version Victor, LS0345 Victor, as amended out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
The bill moves. Let's go off record for a second while we sign the... is House Bill 106, and we have Stacy Steinberg of the Department of Law and Carol Beecher of the Department of Revenue here to present the bill. Please put yourselves on the record and brief the committee on House Bill 106, 29GH1897/W.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carol Beecher. I am the Child Support Services Director in the Department of Revenue. As a brief background of the agency, The Alaska Child Support Services Division is authorized under Title 4D of the Social Security Act. The agency has been in operation since 1976. It is a federally funded program matched at 66% federal, 34% state, and in 2014, the federal funds were approximately $19 million for the program. The mission of the Child Support Services Division is to collect and disperse child support. The Child Support Services Division does not establish or enforce custody. In FY 2014, the agency collected approximately $112 million. 90% of that went directly to families through support, and the other 10% was went to reimburse the state and federal government for public assistance. The current caseload of the agency is approximately 49,000 cases. The Uniform Interstate Family Support Act was drafted by the Uniform Law Commissioners and provides universal and uniform rules for the enforcement of family support orders between states. Alaska passed the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, or UIFSA, in 1996, and by 1998, all U.S. jurisdictions had passed the UIFSA into law. So why do we need to amend UIFSA? After the initial passage of UIFSA in 1986, it was clear that some revisions were required to clarify jurisdictional and controlling order issues. The act was amended by the Uniform Law Commission in 2001, but enactment was not required by the states. In 2007, the United States signed the Hague Convention Treaty on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Forms of Family Maintenance, which is known as the Convention. This convention requires or contains numerous provisions that establish uniform procedures for processing international child support cases. In 2008, the Uniform Law Commission amended UIFSA to incorporate changes required by the convention, and in 2010, the United States Senate gave its advice and consent to the treaty. In September of 2014, the Public Law 113-183, Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, was signed into law, and this law requires all U.S. jurisdictions to enact UIFSA 2008 in their next legislative session. So if a state has a two-year session, this is defined as the first year of your legislative session. So for Alaska, this is July 1, 2015. Currently, 16 states have enacted UIFSA 2008, 25 states have introduced legislation, and 9 states are in the drafting stage of their legislation. And you had a map in the packet that we provided that shows you a breakdown of those states if you want to see that.
Are there any states that aren't doing anything?
Madam Chair, currently it is our understanding that all states are either enacting or have it in legislature or are drafting.
Thank you.
As a condition of the federal financial participation, which is $19 million for Alaska, each state child support agency must have an approved state plan which meets all federal requirements. The Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement determines whether a state plan is approved, and they are requiring states to adopt UIFSA 2008 verbatim. The CS version you have is because the version that we had initially, version A, went before the Office of Child Support Enforcement, and they did some amendments to it to make it verbatim, and this was also reviewed by the legislative legal and our legal staff. So the bill before you will amend UIFSA, and the bill is long, it's 41 pages long, and there are many sections, but most of the amendments consist of cleanup language and clarifying definitions. The primary change is the addition of a new section, which is Article 7, and it's in Section 96 in the bill on page 31. This new section provides guidelines and procedures for the registration, recognition, enforcement, and modification of foreign support orders from countries that are parties to the convention. To date, 33 countries have signed on to the convention, and a list of those countries is provided in your packets in Exhibit 4. Currently, Alaska has about 300 cases with foreign addresses. Of those, approximately 130 are where the non-custodial parent resides in the foreign country. Passage of this bill will provide a better opportunity for Alaska's children to receive the child support from the parents who live in a foreign country. Alaska already enforces foreign support cases if they provide sufficient documentation and have processes that are similar to the way that we currently enforce between states. But this tends to be a one-way street. We enforce their orders, but many countries will not enforce United States orders outside of a treaty agreement. Once the new section of UFSA is in effect, and the signing countries have agreed up front to abide by the uniform method of enforcing child support, but the new section of UFSA will not go into effect until the treaty is ratified. Until then, states will continue to enforce orders in the same way that we currently do. And Stacey Steinberg, who's with me, will provide a sectional analysis of the bill, and then we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name for the record is Stacey Steinberg. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I'm Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Collections and Support Section. Madam Chair, I'd like to give the committee a sectional analysis of the bill. And this is a very long bill, and interestingly, the Committee A had pointed out to me, although the number of the bill is House Bill 106, and it actually has 106 sections in the bill. And I know it's after lunch, a little bit warm in the room, so I'd like to do a little bit of a non-traditional analysis because it is a long bill, and basically kind of give a more of an overview sectional analysis. And starting first with probably the meat of the bill, which would be in section 96, which is a new article that's going to deal with the foreign support orders from the convention countries. As Ms. Beecher had mentioned in her overview, our current law already provides for our state to enforce foreign orders. What's really needed is for the street to become a two-way street for the other countries to enforce our orders. So in Section 96, we'll have a new article that's going to add 13 new statutes to deal with processing requests from other countries. And basically, it kind of mirrors the process that we currently already have in Article 6, which is how we register orders now, with the process of how we register the orders. There is a difference on some of the documents that are required, and so it goes through there. There's also a few differences on the time frame for objecting to the registration. So that's kind of the meat of the bill. And then also, this is part of the 2008 changes. There will be three new statute changes. We're going to add a new statute that deals with the application of the Act to foreign support orders, and that's going to be in Section 20, and we'll have a new AS 2525-104. And also, we'll have a new section that deals with the procedure to register a foreign support order and designate whether you use Article 6 or Article 7 processes. And that's going to be in Section 95 of the bill. And there's going to be one other new statute that's actually not really new. We'll have a new AS 2525-402 that deals with parentage. And it's a new statute, but actually it just got moved from what was formerly 701. It's getting moved, so only Article 7 deals with the foreign support orders. And then there's a host of other changes that are directly related to this new Article 7. And many of them deal with definitions, because under the current act we have, there's this legal fiction that a foreign country can be a, quote, state. And they're getting rid of that legal fiction so that a foreign country is truly a foreign country. And that has to result in a lot of statute changes, including in sections 1 through 16, we have some new definitions, for example, for convention, foreign country, foreign support order, foreign tribunals. And then I went through the sectional and I figured out that we have 21 statutes that are going to be amended to add either foreign country, a foreign tribunal, or define outside the state. And those 21 statute amendments will result in 23 sections, new sections of this bill. And then we also have some cleanup language, fixing some cross-references, and then also providing for, allowing for electronic, a notice by electronic mail, just bringing the statutes into the current day. So there's a lot of changes, but again, the meat of it is in Section 96, and pretty much everything else is dealing with those amendments and some new definitions. The other thing that's part of the bill is by adopting the 2008 version, we're in essence also adopting the 2001 changes by the Uniform Law Commission. And again, as Ms. Beecher had stated, we're currently under the 1996 version because that's what the federal government has mandated to, for our funding. And so we want to, so we're required to update the 2001 changes. And in the statute, I also went through to mark out, well, what's really related to those 2001 changes. In essence, the 2001 changes are really clarifying changes to the laws we already have. And in 2001, we had been using UFSA for about 15 years. So when the drafters went back, they realized, well, we need to tweak this and tweak that. So that's the main part of the 2001 changes, and as part of the 2001 changes, there'll be three new statutes. One of the statutes is going to be in Section 40, and it'll be new ASA 2525-280, which deals with the application of the Act to a non-resident subject to our personal jurisdiction. And then we also have another new statute dealing with, which will be AS 2525-615, dealing with the jurisdiction to modify child support order of a foreign country. If that foreign country either lacks jurisdiction or they refuse jurisdiction to modify, and that's in Section 95. And then the other new statute we'll have, really isn't new, we'll have a new statute 2525-281, which deals with continuing exclusive deals with spousal support, when a state can modify spousal support. And that's actually also in Section 40 of the bill, and it's not a new section. Basically, these provisions are already in our current law in AS 2525-205F as in Frank and 206C as in Cat. But what the drafters did is they pulled those sections out and put them in their own standalone section, partly because while the Act covers spousal support and child support, there are a few little differences, so on those differences, it made sense to make those distinctions and put in its own statute. For example, spousal support, the court that sets the spousal support will always have jurisdiction over the spousal support and the only court that can modify it, and that's different than the rules on modifying child support. And then we had a host, I counted out, 21 sections of the bill deal with more clarifying amendments, and a lot of it deals with, for example, dealing with determining controlling support orders. Under the old law, prior to 96, you could have multiple child support orders, and it was very confusing. And so when this UFSA came into place, we referred to it as there should only be one order at any time for the child. And so there's these rules that the courts use to figure out, well, which, when we have multiple orders, which order is the controlling order. And so there's a lot of these provisions that clarify, for example, when, you know, what court should determine the controlling order. So we have a lot of changes that deal directly with those clarifying amendments. And that those clarifying amendments, they actually touch 29 different statutes, and there's 51 sections in the bill that deal with that. I know this is a little bit different approach, and certainly I would be willing to go line by line through the sectional analysis, but I found that sometimes it's the doing it that way is simply can be just confusing for people, and it's not necessarily very helpful.
Well, to tell you the truth, this whole bill is a confusing bill. It makes the marijuana bill seem really, really clear.
And Madam Chair, and that's specifically why the director and myself are certainly here to testify in the bill to answer questions. It's something that we work with every day, so we don't find it confusing because we're used to addressing it. And so hopefully we can answer the committee questions and make it clear for them and simplify what we do with this. And it is an excellent vehicle for child support. When it was enacted in 1996, it was really problematic dealing with enforcing child support orders through different states, because what was happening before that time is a parent would live in one state and child support would catch up with them and start collecting or garnishing their wages, and then they moved to another state, and under those old laws, it was very difficult to catch up with that parent and have that interstate enforcement. And under this uniform law enacted in 1996, it made the process much more efficient, and the states communicating, having the same laws, and much more efficient. And really what this is doing is really just expanding it beyond just the states and taking it to a more global level. And again, the main point of it is to ensure that children do get support no matter where their parent resides, whether it's in the United States or in a foreign country.
And I see the good intent of it. It does bother me somewhat that the federal government... Now, do I understand correctly that if we do not pass this verbatim, that it's no good?
Through the chair, that is our understanding. We've worked closely with the Federal Office of Child Support, and Congress had changed the law that applies to child support agencies, and basically in that law changed it from saying you're required to adopt what we call UIFSA 1996, and they changed it to say you have to adopt UIFSA 2008. And so we have been in contact with the Federal Office of Child Support, and they've interpreted that as that each state must adopt this in their next legislative session to be continued to be eligible, because as part of their funding, they have to provide a state plan, and their state plan has to be in compliance to continue to get funding. So that is our understanding.
So it kind of makes me a little bit uncomfortable to have the federal government say you have to adopt this in exactly the form that we want it in, or it's no good. I mean, with most uniform rules, there are differences between Alaska and California and Iowa. I mean, they may not be big differences. They're all substantially the same. Would it be possible the next time we have a hearing on this bill to actually bring in an attorney from the federal government who deals with child support with this statute?
Chair, we have had in previous committee hearings, we did have someone from the Federal Office of Child Support testify regarding the verbatim requirement and how that affects our funding. And we also do have available, that was testified previously, is Ms. Lindsay Beaver, who's with the Uniform Law Commission, explaining the uniform laws. And part of the reason is that since this is needs to be uniform among the states, is so that we can have the uniform processing. And there are a few little tweaks that were allowed. We call it the bracketed language, where, you know, for example, not every state calls their child support agency the Child Support Services Agency. And, you know, those types of tweaks are permitted because you have to make sure you're naming the correct agency. But the actual substance of the bill cannot be changed, the act itself.
Well, what about the foreign countries? I mean, are they adopting something that is absolutely identical to this?
Madam Chair, for the foreign countries, what they've done is they signed the convention, and as part of this convention or treaty, they have to agree to do certain things. And the convention is outlined, and I believe that was in one of your, as an exhibit to your packets, outlining, you know, what they have to do. And it does outline, like, it's very similar to what's in our Section 701, Article 7, about what documents do they have to provide and what due process they have to provide.
Another question.
Representative Klayman, then Representative Keller. I'm sure Representative Greenberg must have a question somewhere. So.
And I'm happy to defer to the co-chair.
No, please do.
So, some of the, going back to the topic of the conventions, that what's happened is the Hague, this whole topic about collecting child support internationally became the subject of a Hague Convention treaty that basically said to countries, if both sides sign on to the treaty, then you can collect in the other country, and they can collect in our country.
Through the chair. Yeah, that's essentially correct. Just to kind of elaborate on that, what's currently happening, or before the Hague Convention, what happened is that the Federal Office of Child Support would contract with different countries. For example, they would do what's called bilateral treaties or reciprocating agreements with specific countries like Canada and the Canadian provinces. The problem with that is that it's very time-consuming, and then each treaty would have different provisions on the forms. And so then we have kind of what I call a little bit of a new age approach, where instead of going and trying to negotiate with each individual country, that the countries come together and all agree to the same set of forms and processes. So it just makes it much more efficient processing and dealing with it, instead of each trying to deal individually with each individual country.
And follow up, so the Hague Convention was a means of, instead of the United States having to go out and make one deal with Canada, another deal with Mexico, another deal with England, another deal with France, they could all, four countries or however many, sign on to the Hague Convention, which the Senate has done, and then all the countries just refer to the Hague Convention as a means of dealing with this.
Through the chair, that's exactly correct, and it makes it much more efficient. And part of the reason that it's critical for each state to adopt this language and really adopt it verbatim is that this language is needed to implement the provisions of the convention, because all the states enforce the child support. The federal government directly doesn't enforce it through their federal courts. And so in order for the U.S. to do the final ratification process, the U.S. has to be prepared to say, we can do all the steps that we're required to do under this convention. And that requires each state to adopt these changes. And, you know, some of the changes are very straightforward, like every state has to have a central authority, and that will designate, you know, the entity, and it's the Child Support Services Division that receives the transmittal from the foreign country and processes it. And basically, it doesn't allow Germany or another country to actually come into our country. What it allows is that we'll provide services to them, and we'll enforce their order, and then likewise, you know, we'll send a foreign order to Poland, and we're not going to garnish someone's bank account in Poland, but what we do is the Polish central authority then will enforce our child support against one of their citizens if they owe support, and get that money and then send it back to CSSD so they can give it to the parent that lives here in Alaska with the child. And it is helpful. Another provision is that even though we do some enforcement of foreign countries because our law already provides for it, this is makes it better because of, you know, for example, right now if we have a foreign order from Poland, we have to get that translated, and the translation costs can be very expensive. So, so some of the points are going to be very helpful just to help CSSD with its enforcement and make it more efficient for CSSD to enforce orders. Instead of, they had to pay $1,500 for three different translations so that we could register the order here and enforce it. Under this new Article 7, if it's one of the convention countries, it says in the convention that when they request to us, they have to provide a copy of the order in their native language, and they have to provide a certified translation in our language. So that's just an example of something that's just going to make things much more efficient for CSSD.
Why would we be paying for the cost of translating? I mean, normally, if a plaintiff wants to present testimony or present an order to the court, the plaintiff pays for the translating fees. So why is the state paying for the translating fees right now?
Madam Chair, what the process is CSSD provides services to parents, and they're required, when a parent brings in a support order to them, if it's enforceable, that they enforce it for that parent. And a lot of times that means that the order has to be registered in the court before we can enforce it or do certain things, and so that we're required to get the translation so that we can enforce it for that parent.
So our statute specifically requires that the state pay for the cost of translating? Is that what you're telling me?
Madam Chair, the statute doesn't require it, but as part of registering an order, we need to be able to, even CSD needs to be able to understand what it says so that they can enforce it for the parent.
But you could require, if you wanted to, the parent to have it translated.
Actually, I'm going to defer that question to the CSSD director on that one.
Madam Chair, you are correct. The agency could require the parent, but when it is the custodial parent who is requesting services so she can receive child support, and the expense is so high that she cannot afford it, then the agency does take that as a service that we provide.
Is there a means test to determine whether or not somebody can use your services?
Madam Chair, there is not.
So somebody could have a couple $100,000 income and the state would still be paying for the translation services?
Through the chair, that is possible.
Thank you.
One of the questions, I'm not sure who's better to answer this, one of the questions has been the whole topic of kind of the federal government saying to the states, you all have to adopt the same thing, and I certainly am very sensitive to the notion of federal government overreach. I also gather that this is very much about an international level more than a national level, and it strikes me, I guess, the Poland example, somebody's sending a support order from Poland. If the Polish may not really understand our notion of 50 states with 50 sovereigns, and if every time Poland starts trying to look at Alaska and California and Texas and New York, they have four different statutes that they're trying to understand, we're actually collectively as states not doing much to help the collection of child support by allowing states, because we're really stepping more into an international level than a national level, we're really setting up to make it more and more difficult to have international enforcement of child support orders if every state kind of goes their own path. Am I missing something, or is that part of the reasoning that's going on?
The Chair of Representative Klayman, that is correct.
I apologize, through the Chair, is it also part of the scenario today, without having adopted this legislation, that there are countries that come to Alaska and collect child support from our residents, but because we haven't adopted statutes that would allow the enforcement of the Hague or use of the Hague Convention, that Alaska can't go to some countries and collect child support from that country's citizens because we haven't basically gotten on board with the Hague Convention?
Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, that is possible. I do not have a specific example I can provide of that, but because many of the countries will not collect without a treaty provision, it is possible that that they will not collect for us.
I remember, through the Chair, I thought when you visited in my office, you'd explained that Poland was actually a country in which they can collect in Alaska today, but because we haven't gotten the statute in line with the Hague Convention, they don't necessarily enforce our orders in Poland. Is that, am I getting that wrong, or was that something you, I could, things confused, but I'm checking on Poland.
Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, again, I can provide you with more specifics on that, but in a general sense, the situation is that we already have the structure in the United States, including Alaska, for collecting child support, because we've been doing it a long time, and it's a fairly sophisticated process. Even with enforcement in other states, sometimes there are some disagreements on what can be collected and how they go about it. So that same situation occurs when we are attempting to enforce a support order to another country. They don't necessarily have the central authority set up. Their systems are just different than ours, and they have not agreed to a specific process.
I'm just sort of curious about something. If we are allowing another country to use our courts to collect child support, and that other country is not enforcing our child support orders, why don't we play hardball with them?
Madam, I would say as a general rule, we are required to provide child support services to people who provide us with the appropriate documentation to open a child support order. And we do not view it from the perspective of us and the other country, but rather as one person who needs the child support to be collected for them.
But that would be the person living in the other country, correct? Collecting from one of our residents or citizens?
It could be either way, where we have for instance, the custodial parent could live in Alaska, and we are reaching out to the other country to collect from the non-custodial parent in another country, or the custodial parent could live in the other country, and then they would contact us to collect for them.
So I guess I'm a little bit concerned that we would be, that our courts would be used to collect money for our citizens, which would go to another country, while that other country was not honoring our child support orders.
Madam Chair, that could occur. And to clarify as well, that Alaska is an administrative state, so most of the orders that we do are administratively administered.
What does that mean?
That means that we have the authority to set up the cases and to enforce them unless they are set up in the courts. So someone could go to the court, have a divorce, and then as a part of that proceeding, the child support order is set. So then that would be enforced. We could enforce that for the courts, but it would be set up in the court.
So in a child support proceeding, if the custodial parent were here, wouldn't they simply use the Alaska courts and get another child support order? Why would you need to be enforcing the child support order from Poland or Brazil or Cuba or where have you? Why wouldn't we just have one from here?
Stacy may be able to answer that better from you.
Why don't we let Stacy try?
Okay.
Yes, go right ahead.
We usually make him stand under a light.
Yeah. Drip water in my head.
Yeah, give me water once in a while.
Yeah, through the chair. What the process is in our statute is that if there's no existing child support order, well, then the court will set one. But if there is already an existing child support order, the court's going to look at that, or CSSD will look at that and enforce it. We're not going to, unless there's something wrong with the foreign order, like, for example, they didn't give due process to the parents, we're going to enforce that order and not put another order on top of that. I mean, it goes against the whole principle of our Uniform Act, which says there should be one order in time for the child. And we got rid of this old system that was confusing and bad. There used to be a system where you could have multiple orders in each state, and that principle is extended to even foreign countries. We want one order at a time, so it's clear what order is supposed to be enforced, and that order is enforced. And then we have rules that are set out in our act on when can another jurisdiction modify that order. So it's really under the underlying principle of the act is, you know, the one order at any time. And then that fits in even if it's a foreign support order, unless there's something wrong with that foreign support order, there would be no reason not to enforce that and then follow the jurisdictional rules. At what point in time could Alaska perhaps modify that order if a parent wanted a modification of the order?
So how does that work? If a child support order from another jurisdiction is a lot less generous, perhaps, than a child support order from Alaska might be, or for that matter, a lot more generous than a child support order from Alaska might be. I mean, different countries, different cultures may have different views of divorce, the obligation to support children, etc.
Madam Chair, under our current process, and we even have that with other states, like even within the United States, each state's required to have their own set of child support guidelines, and the requirement is that they have to be
based on some, they have to be numeric and they have to be based on some type of economic basis. And that's permitted under our current system even among states. And so if we have the child support order, we'll enforce it, and then it can be different amounts. And quite frequently it is different amounts. And that that order is enforced until that's modified, and there's a set of rules that governs, you know, at what point in time can another state, you know, modify an order.
Any further questions, Representative Keller?
Yeah, it's if you would correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just trying to get my arms around this whole thing. And this is the second round of hearings, so I'm a little embarrassed asking questions that I should have had answered maybe previously, but. This treaty is not ratified yet until the states comply with this. Am I right or wrong?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that is correct.
Okay, so this is really a novel to me. It just blows my mind, because instead of the Senate voting to ratify or not ratify, they evidently changed the law to say, no, all the states have to comply here in order for this to work. It seems like a completely different process. And then there's two things that come to mind. One is, this is in the context of a threat. If you don't do this, we're going to take your money away. You know, I mean, that was conveyed to us in the letter from the governor. You know, this is, that's what's at risk here, is the federal money. And the other thing is the comments by the Department of Law on this that you gave us that says, hey, this is for our benefit here in Alaska, because we had the input through our uniform commissioners. Instead of, and to me, my mind, where I go with that is, I think the average Alaskan has way more access to Senator Murkowski and Senator Sullivan than they do to the uniform commissioner, and I just don't. It just seems like such an odd process put on us by U.S. Congress, and it's just hard to know. It just seems heavy-handed on the one hand, and it seems impossible on the other. I can't imagine all states are going to pass this verbatim. You know, I can't help but be a little bit cynical that that's going to happen. But anyway, it's more of a comment, Madam Chair, than a question. But I just, you know, to get my brain around it, I would like your response to that.
I'll begin and let Stacey finish or clarify. You are correct, through the chair, Representative Keller, you are correct that this is a rather unprecedented way of dealing with what is essentially a treaty. And the way that it is viewed by the child support entities is that it is a very good way to deal with it. It actually could be interpreted as being much more beneficial to the states and rather anti-federalist, because it has put the vote for ratification of this treaty in the states' hands by way of requiring each child support agency to adopt these amendments to UIFSA. UIFSA itself was drafted by the Uniform Law Commission, but it was based on the input from all of the various states. So the language itself is really the vehicle of the child support agencies across the United States that have worked together to figure out ways to enforce child support across the lines, rather than having language that came down from a signed treaty from the federal government, written by the federal government, to say, states, you must enforce it, and here's the language that we're going to provide you. So we see this, and they could have done it that way, but instead they chose to use the Uniform Act that was working really well between the states and has been an excellent vehicle for enforcing interstate child support orders. I don't know if you want to elaborate.
It's unsettling to me. It seems like it's an administrative act. We're being told, rubber stamp this, trust us, you know, and it's kind of this trust us, please. And there's no reflection on you at all, by the way. It comes from, the federal system that everybody has a different, evaluation here, but $18 trillion in debt and climbing, I kind of gulp. I can't imagine at this point understanding this to the point that I'm comfortable.
So will the Congress ratify this
convention, once the states have adopted this, or is the ratification automatic after the states have adopted this?
Madam Chair, what the process is that the president signed the treaty, and so then the treaty goes through the ratification process, and the Senate already gave its advice and consent. And then the next step is to have all the states adopt what's considered the implementing language for the convention, because the United States has to say, we're going to do these things, and these things that we agree to do are in this bill, that we're going to agree to do this. If you send us X documents, we'll do X for you. And then the next step, after all the 50 states adopt UFCCA 2008, it goes back to the president to finish, my understanding, it would be paperwork and officially sign the instruments of ratification that then get deposited with the Kingdom of the Netherlands. But this is like the one step, and again, normally with a treaty, it's just ratified by the Senate. They give their advice and consent. But this is a different approach that the states have the implementing language so that basically the United States can say, yes, we have all the procedures in place to enforce your child support orders. And again, as Ms. Director Beecher had mentioned, it is a different approach, and at least from the child support perspective, it's seen as a good thing because the child support agencies had input and state law commissioners drafted the changes specifically, as opposed to we had a witness testify previously in state affairs about, well, what was the other option is that Congress would just pass some laws that say states you must do X. And at least in this situation, there were uniform law commissioners that could think it through and have the input from state child support agencies into the process. But it is a different process than probably other treaties have been handled.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to something you asked, and I want to be sure that I understood it. You said if the situation was that the obligor, who's the person who owes the money, was not in Alaska, why do we need this? Or it may have been, I'm not sure. It certainly was one part of the hypo was that the obligor was not in Alaska. And I wasn't clear from what you said whether, I assume, the obligee, the person who's seeking the money, is in Alaska. I think you meant that this was not an Alaskan decree. There had been nothing entered in Alaska. The question was, why do we need to have this treaty, or why can't an Alaska court simply establish a child support order here and take it into the other country to enforce it? Am I reading your hypo correctly?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted to answer. And you guys correct me through the chair if I'm wrong. The reason you can't do that is because there's no personal jurisdiction over the guy in Poland. You'd have to go to Poland or wherever to domesticate it. And you couldn't even take it on an ex parte basis here. Something would have to be commenced in Poland. Let me put it like this. If you didn't, and Poland had a similar due process provision in its constitution, they would say, when the courts of Alaska or Nebraska or anything in between entered this order, there was no jurisdiction over the obligor. Therefore, we don't have to give any full faith and credit. Now you can go into Poland and get your order, and then we have jurisdiction. I think that's right. To the chair, is that not correct?
That is correct. If Alaska is going to set a divorce, and let's say that the dad lives in Poland,
and he's never been to Alaska, Alaska's not going to have jurisdiction to set a child support order over him. We don't have personal jurisdiction. And so in that situation, the mom could come to CSSD and ask CSSD's assistance, and then CSSD would ask the Poland authorities to set a child support order for her.
So even the existence of the child, which was an action, the conception of the child at least, was an action of the person who was in Poland. That action, having impregnated the woman, and then she's now in Alaska, would not be enough to confer personal jurisdiction? Because I know in a lot of cases, personal jurisdiction is somewhat of a, it used to be, once upon a time, somebody actually had to be there in order to confer. And then the courts have expanded that with certain myths that...
Minimum contacts.
Minimum contacts. So would the existence of the child in Alaska not be enough to confer minimum contacts according to our laws?
Madam Chair, just the mere existence of the child in Alaska would not be sufficient minimum contacts. We do have some pretty strong, what we call, you know, the long arm provisions. So if you're not here, kind of setting it up those fictions, those minimum contacts. But if we, under the scenario, if the dad has never been to Alaska, our court doesn't have personal jurisdiction. And Representative Greenberg is correct. It's like, just like we have due process standards, Poland could look at our order and say, well, you didn't give him notice, and you don't have jurisdiction over him, and they wouldn't enforce the order. Just like if the situation was reversed, we wouldn't enforce an order if one of our citizens had never been to Poland and Poland issues a child support order against that person.
May I follow up, please?
You can follow up. I'll let Mr. Representative Klayman ask one more question.
I had one.
You've got one. It's 3:00 now, so you need to
okay.
be very
just,
short.
Yeah, just to make sure you guys understand this. It wouldn't make any difference if there was notice. Notice does not confer jurisdiction. We have in the civil code an article that deals with jurisdiction in a case called Johns, which says basically it's the same as the California long-arm statute. And if there's jurisdiction under the Constitution, there is here. Under child custody, it's more of an in rem situation. And if the kid is here for 6 months, then there's jurisdiction even if the other parent is not here. But support works like this, and it's kind of antiquated, but that's where it is.
I understand. Representative Klayman and then Representative Len.
I know we're going to hold this bill over for another hearing. And I would like at the next hearing a little more information on what exactly the Senate did when it considered the bill. So I have how they can take up the bill for consideration but not give advice and consent but somehow do something a little bit one-off, if you will. And you don't need to explain today, but when the next time we meet, I'd like a little bit more information about kind of exactly what the Senate did and how that fits in. That's my main concern, because I think that's a big part here, is that we've got an internet, we're really not dealing just with interstate relations, we really are dealing with international relations, and the notion that every state gets to sort of do its own thing in the international context is appealing from a state, standpoint of the state's power, but it is not consistent with the notion that we're one nation and we work with other nations.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, just so we're clear on your question, are you referring specifically to the Senate's advice and consent to the treaty?
Right, because I just followed through the chair. I did use the advantage of my iPad to take a quick look, and it looks like the Senate took some action in 2010, but it was something different than ratification, but they clearly approved the thing that there was a vote and the Senate approved it, but it's a little more complicated than simply, here's the treaty, we approve that, we are giving our advice and consent and approving the treaty. They did something less than that, but I don't really understand what that is, and that would help us, I think, a lot in this discussion.
Representative Lev.
Can you please give a simplistic answer to a simplistic question? What would happen if this bill fails to pass the Alaska legislature? What would be the practical result of that? And this is a simplistic answer.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, the Alaska Child Support Program is required to have an approved state plan. in order to have an approved state plan, we must be in line with the federal requirements. And Public Law 113-183 mandated that all states adopt UFSA 2008 by the end of their first legislative session.
And who mandated?
I'm sorry?
Who mandated?
Public Law 113-183, which was passed by Congress, the United States Congress, and signed by the President on September 29th of 2014. The consequences are that we would then not be eligible for the 66% match, and it would also follow into the Temporary Aid for Needy Families Block Grant, which is at $45 million if the state gets through that. The reason that that would also be at risk is because you are required to have an approved child support agency in order to receive the TANF block grant funds. So we don't know what the federal government would actually do, but they are telling us that our funds are at risk and that we are mandated to follow the law in order to be eligible for those funds.
And I've got just one
Thank
question.
You.
Me too.
If Alaska does not pass this, and the other 49 states do pass this, does the treaty become law, or can we hold it up all by ourselves if we so chose?
Madam Chair, it is our understanding that all U.S. jurisdictions must pass UFSA 2008 in order for the treaty to be ratified. So yes, it would essentially not pass until Alaska conceded to that vote.
Thank you very much. We are going to hold this bill over, and for further discussion, if you could also bring somebody from the feds here, hopefully and a federal attorney experienced in I can't pronounce it even.
Interstate Family Support Act.
Yes.
Madam Chair, they should have on the line somebody from the Uniform Commissioner. She was really helpful, that lady.
That would be helpful, too. So somebody from the Uniform Commission. It is 3:04, and we are adjourned.